they were obviously putting a sheet over him, right? To roll him out of the house, down to the ambulance. Guess who wouldn't let that sheet stay on and kept ripping off, ripped it off, and said, "Don't you cover him up. I want everyone to see why his name, nickname was Big Jim." My mother.
Herzlich willkommen zu Gute Typen, der Esquire Cast. Ich bin Dominik Schütte, Ihr Gastgeber, Chefredakteur von Esquire. Und hier werden wir regelmäßig Menschen interviewen, die in unserem Printmagazin vorkommen, die auf unserer Website vorkommen, die wir super finden, die auch Lust haben, besondere Geschichten mit uns zu machen. Und wir freuen uns einfach darauf, hoffentlich ganz viele Folgen mit Ihnen zusammen hier tolle Interviews zu machen. Folge Nummer 1, logisch eine ganz besondere Folge für uns als Esquire-Redaktion. Unser Printheft kommt neu auf den Markt, zeitgleich mit dem Podcast. Und auf dem Cover ist jemand, den man eigentlich nicht vorstellen muss. Ich tue es aber trotzdem. Er ist nicht nur Schauspieler, sondern sogar Oscar-Preisträger seit seiner Rolle in Dallas Buyers Club. Er ist Unternehmer, er hat seine eigene Whisky-Marke. Er hat in einer der besten Fernsehserien aller Zeiten mitgespielt, der ersten Staffel von True Detective, zusammen mit Woody Harrelson, mit dem zusammen er auch irgendwie die beste Bromance der Welt hat. Matthew McConaughey, er hat seine Autobiografie geschrieben. Green Lights heißt das Buch, ist ein bisschen mehr als eine Autobiografie. Letztendlich ist er ja auch erst 50, sondern hat auch viel von Motivationsliteratur. Und darüber wollen wir mit ihm sprechen, denn da drin stehen wirklich unglaubliche Geschichten. Hey Matthew.
Nick.
How you doing?
Good, man. Good. Good, good, good. Running around. Got the family. We're all healthy as we can be. So we're good, man. Yourself?
I'm great. Thank you, Matthew. It's so good to have you. Thank you for doing this. Really great.
Well, my pleasure, man. It's I'm honored with the book, and it's my favorite sort of creative thing I've ever done. And I love talking about it.
Yeah, before reading Green Lights, you know, I thought I knew a lot about you, but man, I know a lot more now. And some of the stories are so breathtakingly funny and really awkward. Some of them I really need to double check with you. But Matthew, before we talk about the book, the pictures your kids took, they are so fantastic. Just thank you for that, and please give them our best regards and our respect. How did you realize that photography might be a great way to spend your time?
Yeah, well, so all I'm doing everything mobile, photo shoots, my Lincoln ads, my Wild Turkey and Long Branch ads. I'm doing everything. I'm not going back to any production right now. I'm saying, look, and I've told everyone, if you want photos or videos or whatever, I'll do them here on site in my yard. And then they were like, how? And I go, I've got my own crew. So my daughter, my daughter and my eldest son, we've always, you know, that's how we shared our camera with them, our iPhone. You go take photos. And then I take photos. And so we sit there and we've always talked about, hey, look how you can frame here. Or what are you trying to get? They have their different styles. And so I said, look, guys, my kids have been looking for ways to make money. And I said, okay, I need a crew. And I said, so I started off with them. I said, look, if one of your shots gets picked out for inside the magazine, I'll give you $20. And if whoever gets a cover shot, I'll give you $50. And they were like, whoop. So then they got excited and they were all three had a camera in there. All three had a camera in their hand, were shooting. We'll see what happens, you know, who gets picked. And then they got into it. Then my son, you know, we got a couple of GoPros. So we shoot these Long Branch ads here. And then he's learned things like, you know, he has all the gear. I said, you have to have all the camera gear, but you have to make sure everything, your batteries, your lenses are clean, your batteries are charged, everything. And what they learned is, I said, look, there's about 30 minutes before the sun goes down. It's called magic hour. So it's the 30 minutes where about 95% of your shots are going to be used. So we're not going to shoot all day in the top highlight. I go, We can practice in the day, but that hour, 6:30 to 7 at sundown, that's when you better have your shit together.
So the cover, Matthew, what was that shot? Was that shot in Magic Hour?
That was right around Magic Hour, yeah. That was right about 6:30, yeah.
And if Levi took the cover, right? So your eldest son.
Levi took that, yeah, yeah. They're into it, and now they're hustling. Now they're all wanting to shoot because they're getting a little bit of allowance for if they get the shot.
Yeah, we're making that happen. We just signed the checks, and they are on their way. So no worries, the kids will get their money.
When they get a check that's signed from like German Esquire, they're gonna feel like they're so legit, right? So I'm talking with them now. I'm going, look, you're 12, 10, and 7. Do we want code names? So no one's thinking you're you know, because we don't want to have the world thinking maybe you're 12, 10, 7. What's your production name? So we got Levi wants Levi the Lightning Bolt.
Okay, do we get their code names? That would be great.
Oh, please.
Wait a minute. Levi is Levi the Lightning Bolt McConaughey?
Yeah, Levi the Lightning Bolt. He got the cover shot. We've got Livingston I gotta go ask him real quick. Hang on a second. I'm gonna step to and ask if they want their code name.
Yeah. Oh, all right. No problem. Ja, und da verließ dann Matthew McConaughey, verließ da das Bungalow und ging raus und hat die Kids gesucht und kam mit den anderen Codenamen zurück. Also Levi, the Lightning Bolt McConaughey, seine Tochter Vida, die ist 10 Jahre alt, heißt Vida Caterpillar, also die Raupe McConaughey. Und der Kleine, 7 Jahre alt, Livingston, nennt sich Aguero McConaughey. Matthew, we got this double spread, eine wunderschöne Doppelseite, sagen wir im Deutschen im Heft, in the magazine, and you're basically laying on a beach with a turtle and a drink in your hand. Can you tell me how that happened?
That turtle shot was in Hawaii, and it was at a place where they have these turtles that they're reintroducing back into the sea. And so there's one area, we found this one beach where there's like 9 turtles within about 100 meters. And they beach themselves, they come up, they hang out. And so I decided, that was Vita's idea. Oh, I want a shot with you hanging out with the turtle with your cocktail.
Okay, but the cocktail, you know, Esquire's, we like a good drink ourselves. What were you having?
That was some Long Branch on Ice.
Oh yeah, that is your Wild Turkey brand, right?
Yeah.
Okay, Matthew, let's talk about the book. What I find so funny is your sense of timing, right? In Germany, we call it your Riecher, yes? Because you wrote the perfect lockdown book, but you wrote it before lockdown. So you will come out with the perfect lockdown book before all the other lockdown books will come out.
I hope so. You know, I wrote it, obviously, pre-lockdown, pre-COVID. But boy, in this times, I sure do think it's going to be, you want some good news in the time of some bad news? Check out green lights. You know what I mean? Yeah. You want a green light in the time of this red light we're in? Yeah, me too. Yeah, I hope so.
Matthew, in the foreword of your book, you write that sometimes you have the feeling that the world has conspired against you to make you happy.
Yeah.
We're not sure yet if that's either really humble or actually megalomaniac. Can you please help us?
Oh boy, maybe it's a little of both. I mean, it starts with humility, meaning like, look, I've had some good fortune that I like don't know the math to how and why it happened. And I'm like, boy, I just got given another gift. Now, I've also, you know, had many friends come up and tell me, they've had many friends come up and go, you've created a lot, you know, you naturally create a lot of good karma for yourself in this life. And I was like, oh, really? And they're like, yeah. And people can feel it. I've had people come up and go, you know, you have people rooting for you that you don't even know. I was like, really? And he said, yeah. I said, okay, well, that's good to know. Look, I don't know how metaphysical it is, but I do know that I am a big fan of other people succeeding. And so maybe and somehow that reciprocates in a metaphysical way where it comes back to where, you know what? People help me succeed. And I'm not, I pretty much go into situations, and maybe it's an energy I take or a spirit I take into it. I go into situations. I'm just meeting you right now. I'm into this situation going like, you have 100% credit in my mind and heart. This 100% credit. I'm going to sit here and be honest. We're going to have a good time. You can ask what you want. I am no part of me is talking to you, or no part of me talks to anybody new, thinking, going in, going like, well, let me wait a minute. What are they really up to? Do they have an ulterior motive? Are they trying to screw me around? You know what I mean? I don't go into things like that. I'm wise enough to catch people sometimes, you know, that do have an ulterior motive that may not be in my best interest. But I have a reverence for everybody that I initially meet. And even if I'm don't know them, and they're anonymous to me, I think very highly of people until they prove themselves the opposite. So maybe there's something in that, you know, where I say I feel like it's conspiring. Too many things in my life have gone my way that I know it took other people putting out effort and good energy my way that helped those things happen.
In my opinion, or in my experience, in every foreword, there's something in that wraps it all up, you know. And it might be the sentence that I just quote. Okay, I was blackmailed into having sex for the first time when I was 15. I was certain I was going to hell for the premarital sex. Today, I'm merely certain that I hope that that's not the case.
That's it.
Is everything in there?
That's it. You're exactly right. You uncovered a really good one. And I don't know, some people may pass over that one. Okay. And it's a wonderful, as you know from my writing, I like little riddles that you can go, wait a minute, what do you mean you were certain then, but now that's the riddle in it. I was certain then at 15. Oh God, I'm going to hell. Now, 35 years later, still a believer, but not so certain that I'm going to hell for that. That was a very sort of 15, black and white, things are black and white, Old Testament, young view. And I was told by my parents, you don't have sex before. And then church says, if you do, then you're going to hell. And now I said, look, I'm not arrogant enough to go, well, I know I'm not. I'm not arrogant to say that. But I'm also a little more, giving myself some amnesty to go, wait a minute. I'm also not going to be as arrogant enough to go, well, I know I am going to hell.
Yeah, well, and the blackmailing was really blackmail. I mean, you write that it was really, how should I put it? It was not a nice experience for you as a young man.
Look, man, again, you know how I think from reading the book. It was devastating at the time, but would I be sitting here right now if that didn't happen? Would I be sitting here if I didn't have whatever that did for me, and however that made me and my mind and thoughts, it could go idiosyncratic at the least. It was not a textbook way to lose your virginity. And it was not a caring, loving way to lose your virginity. It was not a oh my gosh, that was beautiful. It was not. And so how has that shaped me? How is that? I don't really know. But I don't know if I'd be sitting here right now. I don't know. Again, could I call that a green light? I guess maybe. You know, I'm not getting blackmailed into love Megan with my wife now, so we're good.
I'm happy for you for that.
Matthew, we could have 10 interviews just with fun facts about your life and what you did, but I had the feeling we need to concentrate on something. And perhaps just one word about me. I'm the youngest of three boys, just like you. But in you know, very differently than you. I lost my father when I was very, very young, so I never got to meet him.
Oh.
So I'm actually very interested in how you approach fatherhood. And it's a very important topic in your book, because you write very early in the book, you write, first and foremost, and the only thing you ever really knew was that you wanted to be a father.
Yeah. Strange. Your mom?
My mom. Yeah, my mom.
Do you have any children?
Yeah, I have a daughter.
You have a daughter? How old is she?
She's 7.
So where did you pick up your father skills for the last 7 years? Who'd you get those from?
Learning by doing, love.
Yeah. Did you have friends that you were like, oh, I really admire how they raise their kids? No?
Yeah. Of course, they are friends who do this in a great way. But, you know, you write about it in the book. I think that sometimes you need examples that you really don't want to be like. So this is, sometimes I see other parents and I think, no, this is not the way I want to do it. I respect it, but it's...
Yeah. Well, you said something there a second ago that I'd heard my mom say many times, and you see it. I don't think I say it directly quoted in the book, but you see what I mean by the stories I tell. My mom always said, look, parenting, just love them. Just love your kids. You'll not do it right. You'll do it better. It won't, but if you just say, hey, I'm doing this out of love, then you can't go wrong. So it's a pretty, if you're going to have one thing in your pocket, you just said it. So you really can't go wrong. Yeah.
Like a good Southern boy, you started with your mother.
Yeah. I thought that would be apropos.
You know, they are just breathtaking stories about your parents in the book. It's the book basically starts with a scene. Your father comes home and he wants to eat a lot. And your mother says, hey, don't you become a fat man. And well, that thing escalated really quickly. They were threatening each other. They were hitting each other. And it ended with sex on the kitchen floor. I mean, what the hell?
Right? Carney. I mean, wild love, man. I remember, and mom knew, like I said, mom, that picture of mom's middle finger that goes left, right, broken 4 times. She knew what she was doing. I mean, she knew she was poking the bear, my dad, and she would do it. And she, to this day, again, and this is good for the readers to know, and you get it, I think, when you read the book. To me, that's why I start off the book with it. It's the ultimate love story. It's the beauty of brutality that I saw, and that my parents lived. Again, my parents divorced twice, married 3 times. Mom's middle fingers broke 4 times. She, to this day, at 88 years old, is on our porch. And to this day, and every single day in her past, would say, oh, yeah. Oh, I deserve that. I earned that. I needed that. That's what I needed to communicate. So that was how they loved each other. Now, I remember hiding behind the couch, seeing it start, seeing mom start messing with Pop. Come on, fat man. Have some more, fat man. And dad just going, and we're going, oh no, stop it. Mom, stop. And then have some more, fat man. Whop, table goes to ceiling. Mom knows it's on, because here it comes. She poked the bear. The bear woke up. Mom runs over to that phone. Remember those big phones that would hang on the wall? And here comes dad, slowly, just all 6'4", moving across the room. Just as you get, God damn you, Katie. And just as you reach, she's like, bah! Bashed his freaking nose. He goes back. Now we know that's on. The phone's hanging from the wire, the swirly little wire that it hangs from. Phone's going bam, 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 bam. And she reaches over and grabs that blade. Come on, I'll cut you from your Gulliver to your nuts. They started circling. And that's when dad saw that ketchup. And he popped the top off the ketchup. When I say like a matador, she's going like this and he starts going like this.
Also, das muss man jetzt beschreiben. Matthew McConaughey ist in dem Moment aufgestanden und stand also mitten im Bungalow und er spielt praktisch nach, wie seine Eltern sich damals gegenseitig in Rage gebracht haben. Also er, Er steht im Bungalow wie ein Matador und hält eine imaginäre Ketchupflasche in der Hand, mit der er die Mutter beschießt. Später zeigt er mit einem imaginären Messer auf den Vater. Man müsste dabei gewesen sein.
And she's getting covered and it's stinging her eyes. And he's having, he starts going, starts mocking her. And she's saying, touche. And it worked its way to a stalemate. By this time, I'm still crying. Then they stop. She cries. He's got blood running down his face. She drops the knife. He drops the ketchup bottle. They look at each other and just fiercely went at each other and then slowly dropped to their knees and began to make love. That's when I left the room, you know, but there was no like pause on their part. They did not get objective and then go, okay, everyone, hey, boys, get out of that. No, there's no, it was live. And if you were there to witness it, you were there to witness it, but the roof came off the house, then God and the whole world can witness it. This is, they were not asking permission. You know what I mean? And what, you know, talk about a love story and a turn that story starts off with, like, oh my gosh, this is abusive, this is barbaric, this is banal, this is violent, this is a horror picture. And within 8 minutes, 5 minutes, it turns into making love on the floor. I mean, what a quick, talk about a quick moving arch. Look, I just, that is the first example because it sets up how we were parented. And you read about the different ways of discipline and corporal discipline that we had. But what was always paramount, what was always larger than any of the awkwardness or the discipline or the violence, what was larger than all that, unequivocally, was the love. Like I say in the book, many times I've heard, I don't like you. I love you. I just don't like you right now, Matthew. Love was never in question. We were not liked a lot. That was a time when mom and dad didn't like each other. But they also, they had a fever for that rocky road. They had its passionate fever. Like, my mom still to this day doesn't like a smooth sailing river. She doesn't like it when everyone's getting along. She'll throw a wrench in and just jack with you if you're at a dinner table and everyone's just getting along real well. She just needs some, come on, spice it up, let's go. She loves resistance. My mother takes the path of most resistance, not least resistance, to this day. And it's why she's 88 and so damn healthy and vital, because she doesn't like relaxation. As I said in the book, in our family, sleep was sin. You get up. Come on, let's get after it. You know what I mean? Oh, you're griping about no shoes? Let me introduce you to the boy with no feet. Now get your ass back to your bedroom until you're going to come back in here and see the rose in the vase instead of the dust on the table. Now. Oh, okay. I mean, and the other thing is, I've always, when people ask me about the love in our family, for whatever reason, I always tell the stories of discipline. I always tell those stories that you see in the book. Those are the greatest love stories to me that I witnessed and lived through in our family. And the fact that, you know, I'll never forget sitting in the middle in the truck, driving Pat, who got busted for having weed.
Kleine Anmerkung, Pat ist der ältere Bruder von Matthew McConaughey.
That he bought from a guy who actually worked for Dad, which was another big reason. Pat would not rat on the guy that sold him the weed, because he knew that Dad would fire that guy and kick that guy's ass. So that's another thing that made Dad blow up, that his son wouldn't tell him. So boom, it got violent, bam, it was over. And then I remember sitting in the middle, Dad driving here, Pat sitting here, Pat still over there wiping his tears, man, rolling down the window, Dad just driving in silence. To the burger shop that was way across town. So the drive would take longer. And we took the loop around town. And in that drive to Burgers and Fries, which was about 35 minutes, Pat's wiped his tears, caught his breath. Dad slowly reached over and turned up the radio a little bit. We all kind of got in the jive of one song. Dad brought up something. Dad said the first word about something we saw, you know, it was about sunset, something we saw that was cool, and oh, isn't this burger gonna be good? And all of a sudden, that was the end. There was never another word said about what Pat had done wrong. Not another word. And none of this, like, if 2 weeks later Pat got in trouble. None of this, like, and 2 weeks ago you did that. It was completely in the rearview mirror. Done, forgotten, handled, and never to be brought up again. And if anybody ever in our family brings up something that someone did, well, remember what you did back then. That person got in trouble. Like, going, how dare you? That was done. We put that to bed. You don't dare bring that up. And I mean, boy, that was just understood in our house. But I remember that that drive, that was a healing drive. And I'm in, and slowly on that drive, my shoulders start to relax. And all of a sudden, we get burgers, and then we get extra ketchup and extra fries and come home. We get to watch them in front of the TV and stay up as late as we want on a school night. It ended up being a love story.
Well, as you tell those stories, you see there's obviously a lot of passion, but also a lot of violence involved. For example, all you three boys, you were crossing the brink of being a man in the eyes of your father in very, very violent and strange situations. Do you have to be careful sometimes, you know, not to become your father?
Cool. Yeah, good question. It's something that I fully respect. Look, the generation my father grew up in, how he grew up, how he was a physical man. He was a very smart man, but how he was a physical man, and that was how he communicated, and that was how I saw my mom love him, and how my mom was a feisty little New Jersey girl who didn't want to sit there and talk things out. Let's have it out. You know what I mean? And she started those fights with him. You know what I mean? She pop him in his forehead. I remember. And he'd be like, God damn it, Katie, stop it. Pop, pop, pop. It's not Katie, stop it. No, come on. Pop. And then all of a sudden, gosh, damn it. And there it goes. I don't choose to. I'm not a physical disciplinarian. I've chosen not to. I haven't even been in that many fights in my life. I have a switch I can flick, but not with my family. And like Camilla and I, we do like a smoother river than my mom and dad like. Camilla, listen to this story. Camilla, my wife now, her parents were married twice, divorced three times. So we both come from parents that would, I can't live with you, can't live without you. Mine ended up married, hers ended up divorced. So you would think, like, geez, are we afraid of marriage? We talk about it, and we're not really. Neither one of us see our parents as like bad examples. We see them as good passionate love stories that tried to make it work. Sometimes it did, sometimes it didn't. I don't remember the last time I raised my voice to my wife or my kids. Now I've had to do it for, I'm gonna do it for an attention getter. Hey, you heard what your mom said. I'll do that, but never in anger, just to get their attention, never in anger. If I get angry enough where I raise my voice then I immediately feel like, oh, what crumbs did you leave leading up to this point? What did you not handle leading up to this point that it got to a point that you had to explode? So I've always had a handle on that. It's not really something I'm running from. It's just something I've chosen to go, you know what? I'm going to do it differently than my father did. But I'm not even arrogant enough to say that his way was wrong. I can't even say that at all. I think the way, as I say in the book, I wouldn't trade one of those butt whoopings for the values that I got from them. And they were always done for the right reasons. Like I said, I say it in the book. Don't say can't. Say I'm having trouble. That's a good life lesson. And it was a good reason that I got in trouble. Don't, you know, answer to your own name. You know, not Matthew instead of Matt. That was from mom. What was another one? There was don't hate. I remember the time. I remember that ass whooping I got. It was at my own birthday party. And I told my brother, who was Jack with me, I said, "Oh, stop it. I hate you." And I said it because I had heard someone say it at school. And right when I said it, I knew, I was like, "Ooh, that might have been a bogey. That might have been, you might have messed up." And my mom stopped the party, my own party, told all the kids, "Shut up, quiet, everyone, everyone." And me on came to me in my birthday party with a cap on and goes, "What did you just say?" And I went, "She, what did you say to your brother?" I said, "I hate you." Whop, right there in front of everybody, man. Don't you ever say that word, hate, especially to your brother. We do not hate. Whoa, man. That was a really good ass whooping to get. That stuck with me. I haven't used that word ever. And the fourth one is not lying. I lied to my dad about stealing that pizza, man. As I said in the book, if I'd have just said, "We stole the pizza, shit, we got caught," dad would have been like, "Ah, dang, you got to get better at it, son. Let me tell you how to get better at stealing a pizza. You're obviously not good enough at it right now." But because I lied, that's what broke his heart.
Was that the moment where you could have become a man in the eyes of your father, but it didn't happen the way, you know, perhaps he expected?
If that night, if I would have said, like I should have, "Yeah, we tried to get away with it. Shit, we got busted." He would have been like, "God damn it," you know, and would have kind of got on me a little bit because I got caught. Remember the whole story through the theme through the story was don't get caught. But he just said, like, "I've stolen plenty of pizzas and da da da. I've stolen plenty of blah, blah, blah." But you got, and it would have been. We would have had our beer later that night, you know, but I didn't. I lied and I crumbled. I pissed my pants. I choked, you know, and that to him was just, he was just like, "What can I do as a father, man? What, my own son, you're lying to me about that? You're not man enough to own up to that?" No, I wasn't. My brother Rooster was earlier. You know, he would have. I was the chicken shit, you know, and it wouldn't have been. And that's what I remember the look on his face so clearly. It broke his heart. And he was like at a loss. What have I done? What can I do as a father that I've got a son that I'm raising and he's too chicken shit to just tell me the truth about stealing a damn pizza, man. It broke his heart. He was trying. That would have been a rite of passage. If I would have admitted it that night, that we would have become buddies that night. But I didn't. I failed the test.
Your middle brother's crossing the brink moment, so to say, was when your father woke him up in the middle of the night to take him to a high pissing contest, which he actually won because he didn't let your brother pee all the time until they've been there, I think, 150 miles away. I mean, what the actual F?
We didn't have much money, man. Pat wanted a motorbike. I mean, dad was pretty quick on his toes to be out there at that ranch, and they were having a pissing contest when old, what's his name, said, "He can't piss over my head. I'm 6'7". And dad's light went off. He had his eye on that little motorbike in the corner. He was like, "I know somebody who can piss over your head. Hang on, I'll be back." And he drove over 100 miles back, got my little brother up. And, you know, "Here, have a beer on the way. You ain't going to piss. I know it hurts, but we got some gold at the end of the tunnel here." And whew, did it. There we go. Dad wanted to get Pat a little motorbike, but we couldn't afford it. So, I mean, it's another carny way of getting what you know, getting what you want.
He did his part.
Yeah. A few days after you said your first words on film, all right, your father died.
Five days
after. So almost 30 years ago.
Yep.
He had a heart attack while climaxing. And you, in your life, had several wet dreams that changed the course of things. So I wonder, McConaughey guys and life-changing orgasms, or in the case of your father, even life-ending orgasms. I mean, what's the problem?
What is the gift? You know? Yes, I have literally chased down wet dreams. My father's heart was unable to pump enough blood to the rest of his body as he climaxed with my mother, his wife, at 6:30 a.m. August the 17th, 1993. He had told us, boys, when I go, I'm going to be making love to your mother. He called the shot. We were like, oh, that'd be awesome. And then all of a sudden, I got that call. Mom had waited all day to call me. She called me that night while I was in Austin, and I drove back that night. And then to hear the stories from the neighbors, check this out. I didn't put this in the book. When the ambulance came to pick him up and the neighbors were all out, they put the gurney on, and Mom's still in her nighty negligee, you know, morning negligee that she slept in, and they had just made love. They were obviously putting the sheet over him, right? To roll him out of the house, down to the ambulance. Guess who wouldn't let that sheet stay on and kept ripped it off and said, don't you cover him up. I want everyone to see why his name, nickname was Big Jim. My mother. Neighbors everywhere. Mom wouldn't let rip the sheet off the gurney. And crying and screaming, don't you dare cover him up. Why don't you see him how he went out? See why his nickname was Big Jim. It was carny, but so full of life, man. I mean, you see me when I smile, I tell these stories to smile and laugh. I think they're beautiful. And so, yeah, I got that call. I went back. We had the wake. And then the family said, get back. Go back and do your job. And I talk about it in the story. There is serendipity in the fact that he actually was alive. He didn't get to see me do it, but he was alive when I started doing the thing that became a career for me. And what I mean by that is there were things before that, you know, dad, can you help me buy the skateboarding elbow pads and the knee pads and skateboard? Well, you sure, son? I mean, you really want to skateboard? No, dad, I really do. That's what I want to do. I really want to work on it. And I got, you know, and he pitched in and got me the pads and stuff, and I never followed through on it. I never became a good skateboarder. I kind of did it for a couple of weeks and kind of left it. And so looking back, there are things that I did that I was like, oh, I really thought that was going to be a passion of mine, and I didn't follow through. So I kind of half-assed it. And I talked my dad into helping me out with something and helped me, and I half-assed it. And now, oh, later on, I was like, oh, but he was alive for the first thing. You know, those were all these little one-off fads I tried and hobbies. And now I go, oh, he was alive for the first 5 days that I started something that was more than a fad, more than a hobby, more than a job, became a career. And so that, I'm like, we overlapped. Me becoming and doing what I've done overlapped with his passing. While he was still alive when I started it. And I find some solace in that.
As you said, you already said your famous first three words. Does that, you know, soothe you? Does that help you thinking about your father's death?
Yeah, I mean, look, I never thought about the meaning of those three words, sort of in relation to his moving on. What's that, buddy? That was Levi. But as I say in the book, you know, it's why I'm still honored to hear those words and find it a compliment. And someone either tattoos them on their inner thigh, says them out loud, or puts them on a T-shirt. It's the first three words I ever said in my first 5 minutes of the job that I thought might just be for two nights, and that was it. And then I would have gone on and become whatever else I would have become. And so there, that when I talk about launch pad lines, that was my career. That was my launch pad line for all of my career.
Okay, as I said, there are several wet dreams that changed the course of your life.
Yeah.
Wet dream number one, and I may quote, I was seeing myself floating downstream on my back in the Amazon River, wrapped up by anacondas and pythons, surrounded by crocodiles, piranhas, and freshwater sharks. There were African tribesmen lined up shoulder to shoulder on the ridge to the left of me as far as my eyes could see. I was at peace, then I came, and I woke up. Could you please tell us what's going on?
Yeah, sure. So this dream was 11 frames.
Oh yeah, the frame thing. Can you explain? I didn't get, what do you mean by frames in that sense?
11 frames. Snapshot. 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 11 frames, 11 seconds. So there were 11 images. I was myself. I had my POV. I was wrapped up in all these the anacondas and snakes and stuff and sharks and fins. And then I was up above and I saw myself as a small figure wrapped up going down this Amazon River. I then was back in a POV and saw in the foreground the pieces of the shark fins and the snakes. And then to the left, there was a large rocky cliff. And it was way up high, where right to the left of me as I was floating this way. It was probably, 100 meters high here. But from there, all the way down until it dipped into the horizon, there were African tribesmen, black tribesmen in tribesmen gear, shoulder to shoulder with shields and spears. It's linear, I mean, tens of thousands. They would have been lined up until they were just until it went off into the horizon. There were 11 total shots, frames like that. That's the 11 frames, 11 seconds. And then I had a wet dream. So as I talk about it was not your usual wet dream. It wasn't sexual relations and I was the only person there and I was in contact with. And all of those elements in the dream, in the 11 frames, I remember this, that the beginning of the dream, when I was wrapped up and couldn't get free, but it was a nightmare. I remember clenching up, I'm going to break my molars, having a really bloody nightmare here. This is horrific. And that within the 11 seconds, I went from this is a nightmare. Oh God, is it real? To all of a sudden I relaxed by frame two into, no. And then all of a sudden I wasn't fighting back in the dream. All of a sudden the dream went from being a nightmare to a beautiful dream. And whoa, this is wild and mystical. And what does this mean? Oh, geez. And I wasn't fear. There was no resistance. I wasn't. And then I came. So within 11 seconds, it went from nightmare to wet dream. Again, another very, wild, quick arch. And the thing is, I had that, and there's two things I knew. So I wake up from a dream like that, and I'm going like, whoa, what's that? What's that? Two things I knew in the dream, geographically. I'm on the Amazon River, and those are African tribesmen on the ridge. So what do? Well, me, I go to the Atlas and open up in the continent of Africa. For an hour and 45 minutes, I looked for the Amazon River in Africa. And I remember I called my buddy who's in the book, Rob Bindler. I was like, dude, where's the Amazon River? I'm not finding it. And he goes, wrong continent, dude. I went, oh, of course, it's in South America. So then I found it in South America, decided to go, okay, I have two spots on the globe. I have two continents, actually, South America and Africa. One is the Amazon River, the other is Africa. I packed up a backpack and flew down to Peru and hiked my way to the Amazon and floated it.
Wet dream number two took you to Mali.
I have the same dream again. What is it? How many years later? 4 or 5 years later. exact same 11 frames, 11 seconds again. Exact same. And I came. Now I wake up and I go, whoa, okay. I guess I have another half of the, I didn't fulfill the promise of that dream, the trip that I took to the Amazon 5 years ago. That must have only been half of it. Obviously, the other half is the African tribesmen. So then I'm stuck with, well, geez, Africa's a huge continent. That's the only sort of intel I have on this, is that it's African tribesmen. And I was in the Morrison Hotel in Dublin on the north side of the Liffey River. And I'm sitting there just thinking about it. I just finished Rain of Fire. I'm like, I'm over here on the eastern side. I know I need to go to Africa. Africa's closer from here. I don't want to go back to the United States. While I'm here, I should leave here and go to Africa. And then I'm like, but shit, where? And I had been listening to the guy, Ali Farkatore.
Matthew McConaughey schreibt in seinem Buch hier, dass damals viel Ali Farkatore gehört hat. Ali Farkatore war eben ein Musiker aus Mali und sein Spitzname, habe ich auch erst nach dem Interview ehrlich gesagt rausgefunden, aber sein Spitzname war The Blues Man of Africa. Also irgendwie die Musik dieses Mannes hat Matthew McConaughey für die nächste Reise inspiriert, von der er jetzt sehr ausführlich erzählt.
Oh, geez, he's from Africa. Where's he from? And I picked up the liner notes and said, Niafunke, Mali. Opened up the atlas, found Niafunke, Mali. Went down there in Dublin, got my shots. Packed up my backpack, flew to Bamako, the capital of Mali. Hitchhiked like 9 hours to Mopti, got dropped off. And they're all speaking Bambara. I don't understand what anyone's saying. All I'm saying is I'm going, I want to go find Ali Farka. Hitchhike, go, Mopti, yes. Get me back, like in the back on the side of a truck, 9 hours. They drop me off, get out, got my backpack, and I don't know where they're dropping me off. And they just point at this place, and they call me Dauda, because I went under the name David. And then they, boom, left me in a cloud of dust and drove off. And I hear this male voice coming from inside this little hut, speaking Bambara, but singing. And the guy was taking a shower. Okay, and I'm sitting outside, and all of a sudden, in the middle of the singing, evidently he had seen me out front, and he just stops and he yells out and he goes, "Put your bag down, you are home." Finished his shower, came out, and he spoke some English. He says, "What is it you look for?" And I said, "I'm looking for Ali Farkatore. I want to go find him." And he's like, "Okay." I go, "Do you know a guide?" He goes, "Yes, I know good man. I know good man for you." He goes, "Meet me this place tonight, 6 o'clock, dinner." I get there for dinner. There's a third man there, Issa, who is in the story, is prominent in these stories. And I sit there with Issa. Issa speaks some broken English. I tell him what I want to do. He works it up. "Yes, I can have my boat ready in 2 days. I will need to have my friend Ali, who runs, make sure the boat's running well. And I will also have Amadou with us. He will do the cooking and we will go upriver. It'll be 4 days to get there, but we can find Ali and Niafunke." He gives a price. I sit there and go, "Nah, come on, man, that's too much price. Discuss." And I talked him down and gave him a price over the table, and he agreed to it. He then paid, paid that guy that he dropped me off, who introduced me to him, his sort of finder's fee, gave him some cash. And then all of a sudden, I'm on the boat, we're going up river, we're camping out along Bozo Fisherman, and we pull into a place called Niafunke. And go into town looking for Ali. 30 minutes after looking, we're walking through, and this Land Cruiser's coming at us and makes this turn, comes flying by this sandy road, and just whoosh, dust and sand everywhere. And as it clears, Issa goes, "This is Ali! This is Ali!" So we go heading down there into town, following. He's way ahead of us. We go into town. We go to his first wife's house. "Where's Ali?" "Ali is not here." Okay. We look around. We find out he's Muslim, so he's got a second wife. So we go to his second wife's house, and he's there. There's Ali. Ali does not know me from Dauda, which is the name I'm under Dauda. He is told by Issa and Bambara, "This American man named Dauda has come to Mali. You are one of his favorite musicians. He has come to meet you." "Oh, good, good." His wife makes up a meal. We sit on the floor in a bowl. You eat with the right hand, you know, not the left one or whatever that's the manners. I remember this. He had an orange crush, right? Which was a, remember the, you know, the drink, the orange soda. He had an orange crush. He didn't offer me an orange crush. He had the orange crush. I had water. He didn't offer anyone an orange crush, but we sat around and ate. He then went and put on videos of, and for whatever reason, I had blanked at this time in front of him with him. I had blanked on this favorite song of his, I Do, A-I-D-U. A beautiful love song. If you get a chance to listen to it, have a listen. It's my favorite love song ever. And it's about trusting yourself and trusting humanity. It's not actually about a woman at all. And it's in Bambara, so I had always thought it was a romantic love story, but then when I read the liner notes, it's actually about trusting mankind. Anyway, I'm blanking on what this song is because I want to tell him how much I love this song and what it's meant to me. He puts on this video and he's talking, and East is translating. East says, oh, this is a concert he had in Paris where he made the rain stop. And we're watching this video on a VHS and it's raining. And I hear this, bow down, bow down, bow down, bow down. The opening notes of I Do that he's playing live in the concert in Paris, and he's playing and it's pouring down, and he starts talking in Bombard to the French crowd. He looks up and he keeps playing and the damn rain stopped. The rain stopped, and it was that song. I was like, that's the song that got me to come to you. We leave, we go back to the boat. Now I'm like, what now? Where do we go? And that's when Issa stepped in with his celestial prophecy. I believe you go to, and he told me that thing about through translation. I said to Ali, you know, why do you not play in America? Why do you not play more in Europe? And the translation was, as I wrote in the book, because there I would be dried shit. Neither me nor my scent would stick with you. But here I am wet shit, both me and my scent stick with you. So then I ties in anecdotally in the rhyme of life to me going, and Issa said, you should go to this place where you will remember it. And the idea of the wet shit being sticking with someone's memory made me go, yes, wet shit. That's where I'll go. I'll leave my mark there. So let's go there. And as you see, I go through the story. And then as you see, 5 years after that, I had left my scent. I was wet shit. When I went back, and Michelle walks me those 15 miles back to the next village, the same guy I wrestled 5 years earlier.
Genau, kleine Anmerkung hier aus dem Off. Michelle ist ein Wrestler aus dem Dorf, mit dem Matthew McConaughey einen Wrestling-Kampf aufgeführt hatte 5 Jahre später. Und 5 Jahre später hatte er ihn wieder getroffen. Are you thankful to your jizz? Yeah, you know, criminal investigators say you have to follow the money, the blood, or the sperm, the jizz, you know. Are you a good investigator in your own bodily fluids, so to say?
I seem to have listened in some of the right places. You know, I listened to those wet dreams. They interrupted my flow and said, hey, you need, to me, they came across as signs. To me, that was a higher power speaking to me, giving me a celestial sign that goes, hey, you have something in your journey you need to follow here. And so me being someone who's always looking for a grand, great adventure in life and a mystery to solve, a riddle to figure out, a fugamundi to head out on, I followed those. And they've paid huge dividends for me in some of the most important pivotal times in my life. Yeah.
In those beautiful 10 to 12 minutes you got in Wolf of Wall Street, You are very precise and you are very, you know, very keen on giving Leonardo DiCaprio's character, Jordan Belfort, this very, very important advice. And the advice is to jerk off and to jerk off really often because it doesn't work without that shit. Is that your private opinion too?
Well, for Jordan, for the guy I played, you dare in the stock market. Yeah, as I said, you got to get some bass with all this treble, a little mayonnaise with all the mustard. We got to get all the ding 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 dings out of us. We got to get down baseline. So go jerk off for a couple times a day. That's rookie numbers, man. You got to make this a practice. All right, for you, go in there, level out, keep the baseline, so you can stay out of all this static, all the static. Now look, personally, hey, that's up to everyone. Monks don't do it. But sometimes you got to move things around, get the energy flowing, and you're blocked up. It's good to clean the pipes.
Well, I mean, in your book, there's a workout list, and jerking off is on there.
Hey, for some people, some days, some of us, that's it. That'll be it. Hey, it's legitimate. It's one legitimate stop on the workout scale from having a glass of water to running a marathon or being a triathlete.
Matthew, wet dream number 3. It got you married.
Yes. Yes, it did. You know, and this one, I hope I wrote it well enough where you see the beauty of that story, because when I tell, if I don't tell that story well, it confuses people how that led me to be able to meet the woman in my life. But it was a time, and I think many of us do this, have some form of this in our lives when we're looking for a mate. We can sometimes try too hard. We can sometimes be looking for it too hard, be trying to meet somebody we get along with and immediately start thinking like, well, wait a minute, maybe this is the one. And we can maybe turn them in. We can even, maybe sometimes we make someone who's not the one, we make it work for us. And maybe we shouldn't have. Other times we maybe try too hard and speed up a relationship too quickly and we break up and we never really know if maybe that was the one for us because we tried too hard and we weren't really ourselves, weren't allowing them to be themselves. So I was in a time in my life where I was happily single, but I was sort of, I felt myself starting to looking for, feeling like I needed to find the right one for me and not as present as I wanted to be, not as happy with my own company as I wanted to be. It's kind of like a clock ticking, like going, hey, it's that time in your life, Matthew, it's time. And all of a sudden I had that dream where I was an 88-year-old bachelor, 88 kids, mothers showed up, married to none, but all happy, and they were all my children. And that was a wet dream. Again, the elements of that could be a nightmare. You have a dream about being an 88-year-old bachelor, never finding the woman for you. For some of us, sometimes that can be a nightmare. But what it did, because it was a wet dream, I woke up and went, okay, let me think on this for a while. It was okay that you were an 88-year-old bachelor. It wasn't a nightmare. It was okay. So I said, Matthew, it's okay. That's God telling you it's okay to carry on your life. You don't have to find the right woman for you and get married. That didn't make me say I don't want to get married. It did not make me say that. It just made me say it's okay if I don't. And as soon as I said it's okay if I don't have to force and look for the right woman. I need to be more like a spider, just wait in my web and be myself. Then she came. And she moved across the room, left to right in front of me. And I did not say, who is that? I said, what is that?
So Camilla, she's your wife, the mother of your children, and you fulfilled your dream. You know, you always wanted to be a father. Let's talk about how you approach fatherhood.
Well, I'm going to go back to the one we shared early on an hour ago. When you're stuck and you're not sure if you're doing it right, just say, hey, do I love him? Am I loving him? And you really can't go wrong if you just go, look, I'm just going to give him all the love I got. I could go on a bunch of philosophies and importances that I feel in fatherhood that I'm doing my best to practice. So as a father, I'm a shepherd of them. I have learned this, and you probably learned this with your daughter. I used to think it was much more environment that we become who we are over our environment more than DNA. With every day that my kids and my oldest one's 12, with every day that they've lived, I'm reminded more and more that it's DNA. They're hardwired. They kind of are who they are. DNA matters a lot more than I thought before having children. I see that, yeah, I can nudge them. I can put things that turn them on and that they love in front of them. I can try to remove things that are too harmful for them. Keep those out, get them out of their path. But boy, they are who they are. And they're already extremely individuals. And yes, they pick up some things from me. They pick up things from my actions. They pick up certain things, but essentially they already are who they are. So that realization is something that hit me years into fatherhood that I was like, wow, I did not expect that. Secondly, it's a question of when we open up, what does it mean to love a child the best you can? Does that mean you keep them away from all harm, all resistance? I don't think so. I think, I look at it like, what's the height of to use the analogy of a tree limb, that a child climbs a tree and goes out on a tree limb. Child's not afraid to climb high into a tree until they fall. It's only after they fall that you go, wow, now I'm kind of scared of heights. Before you fall, before anyone tells you, oh, don't go higher, you just go. Well, for my money, the way I'm trying to be a parent is, if you're up there on that tree limb, that, hey man, if you fall, you're pretty good. You're gonna get a hell of a bruise. It's gonna hurt. I'm probably gonna let you keep climbing, not say a word. Now, if you get way up into that tree where you're like, dude, if you fell from there, you're majorly injured. Now, if it gets to that height, I'm gonna be like, hey buddy, Come on down here just a second. Come on down a little lower. I want to talk to you, without alarming them. Because if you got a kid way up on top of a tree and you're like, oh no, don't do it, all of a sudden they freak out and they go, what? and then they may not climb as well. So it's those things that I want our children to, it's like put a bunch of children on a playground and just have free play. Don't have an organized play. Let them argue. Let them work it out. Don't go, hey guys, let me get in the middle of it. No, let them negotiate. Let them work it out. Let them win, let them lose, let them win the argument. Let them choose to carry on or go do something else. That I think is a very good form of loving a child, a responsible way to love a child. Other times it's like, well, no, I want to remove that harm from my child's way or redirect them because that could really hurt them. And I don't want my child to really get hurt. That's also a very kind of responsible love, I believe. So I think it's balancing those throughout their life, letting them be able to negotiate, because once they're out of the house, if you've coddled a child too much, they will be ill prepared to handle things in the real life, because the world's not fair. Not everyone is out for what's best for you. Not everyone, the world is not fair. You can get fired. You can from jobs. People, there's competition. There's people who don't really have your best interests in mind. So I want them to be up to speed with the realities of the world, but also understand that we fully believe in our family. And you see it through what I write about in the book. I believe in the goodness in people. I believe, as I said, you started off the conversation in ways the world's conspiring for my happiness. I mean, I believe in that. Now, just believing that has also brought me happiness, or made that true in ways that maybe it wouldn't have been if I wouldn't have believed that. We want our kids to understand what, be ready, they be autonomous children, conscientious and confident. And I want them to be individuals. That's what I mean by autonomous. And that's been one of the assets of this COVID time for us as a family. My children have doubled down into creative things that they love to do, like Levi with making short films and photography, and Vita sewing, fashion things. They're doubling down on those. And if they were in school, physically in school with all their friends, I don't think they would have invested their time in these creatives. They wouldn't have. So what I hope is that when they do go back and engage in school, they'll have the confidence in their own, what they do, that if there's 20 kids and 19 want to go do that, but they want to do something else, they can go, no, I'm good. I'm going to go do this. I hope they have that kind of confidence.
Is the boy's father, Matthew McConaughey, the same person as the daughter, father, Matthew McConaughey?
I think so. My wife may beg to differ. Again, back to the DNA, how they're all who they are. And I write about having a daughter, how it's the only honeymoon that lasts forever in the book. It's pretty close to the same father. It's a bit of a different relationship, and it's kind of becoming one now that she's 10. There's certain things that boys talk to their mother about, certain things boys talk to their father about. There's certain things girls talk to their mother about, certain things they talk to their father about. And you have different children start to have different relationship about different things in their life with different parents. And we're completely fine with that. We're always like, hey, don't want to talk to me about it? Go talk to mom about it. Don't want to talk to mom about it? You can talk to me about it. And Camilla and I do that vice versa. You can talk to whoever, or if you want to keep it to yourself, you can do that, but just know you can share it with us. And you're not going to say anything to us that we're going to go, oh, you what? We're going to go, yep, know that deal. Yep. That happened. This happened to me in this way. You know, but Vita in our family, she's actually got the most scientific mind. She's the one that sums things up. Levi and I are the storytellers, conspiracy, you know, let's figure out this theory. Where are the car keys? Can't find the car. Having trouble finding the car keys. Maybe they're in the coat pocket that I wore yesterday when I parked the car. But the coat pocket's not hanging on the coat rack. So maybe Mama moved it to the storage closet. And while we're doing that, coming up with these scenarios, Vita's over there drawing something. Don't even think she's listening. And she'll just kind of come by without even looking at us and go, here you go, Popeye, and hand me a picture she drew. And I'll, oh, that's really great. And she'll go, thank you. And as she walks off, go, did you check the ignition? And sure enough, the keys will be in the ignition. So she's the one that kind of breaks stuff down to, come on, it's not, it's all simple. You know, she's actually our tech wizard in our house at 10. Hey, buddy.
I made a new color.
You made a new color?
Yeah, come here.
Say hi.
Hi.
This is Livingston.
Wait, he's in Muji or something.
No, he's with German Esquire.
Wait, no.
He likes your photos.
And he's also muted because we can't hear him.
Is he muted?
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I'm always muted. So you know, there's no noise, no noise in the signal. Buddy, how you doing? It's so great to see you. Thank you for the great photos.
You're welcome.
Unbelievable. You are so talented, you kids. Oh, and we pay for it. There's some checks coming.
There's some cash coming. He's writing the checks. They're coming.
Yeah. Jetzt tanzt der kleine Livingston McConaughey quer durch Bengaluru. Freut sich sehr.
Yeah, and that's the youngest. That's Livingston. And he's our house comedian. I think I'm pretty similar on how I parent both of them. We're getting into those teenage years. Things will change. We'll have to customize. You know, Vita will be going through things, and females go through different things than boys do. Boys go through their own different things, through their own adolescence. And the awkward ages are coming up, you know? Him, he's 7. He's in a dynamite year. It's easy. He's all for one for all. Hey, win, lose, I don't care. Let's have a great time, you know? And as you get older, things get a little more complicated. I know my life became a little more complicated. I start questioning things, trying to question things with my own body, et cetera, et cetera. So that's all coming on. Maybe ask me in another 5 years about how parenting my daughter is different than a son, and I might have a better answer.
All right, I will send you another Zoom invite.
Yeah.
Wrapping up the topic of fatherhood. Do you still think a lot about your father? Sometimes you even talk to him, right?
Yeah, I'll talk to him, or I'll have him in my prayers, or I will be doing something that's fun or original, and I'll picture him there and go, ah, he would have loved this. Ah, he is loving this. He would have thought this moment was so cool. He would have liked to read this script. He would have liked to watch this movie. He would have liked to gone on this hike. He would have liked, oh, I would have loved, he would have loved being at this game. He would have loved talking football or sports about this. He would have loved talking about the world. I would have loved talking to him about those things. Ah, he is still there. So what do you think? You know what I mean? And I've seen him grow and change. I've had conversations with him where he's having conversations with me that are different than he would have had with me 30 years ago. I've seen his ideas evolve, you know, in conversations with me. So yeah, I try to keep him as current and alive in my life as much as possible.
Very nice. Thank you.
What was that, buddy?
Hey, it would be fun to talk about football with Paul Mack.
Yeah. He literally just said it would be fun to talk about football with Paul Mack. It would be real fun.
Well, Matthew, let's wrap it up. You know that we want Esquire Germany to be very optimistic, and I'm so happy about the picture we have for the cover. But I don't have a cover line yet. So would you help me out? If you were my, you know, co-editor in chief, what should we write on that great cover?
Look up.
Yeah, in German we have a saying, it's just Kopf hoch, you know, like chin up.
Yeah, I mean, keep your head above water and bless up. You know, after, because I'm coming, we're all in the deep, we've all been in the deep dive. We've all been beneath the surface going, where's the surface of the water, man? Come on, let's get on top of it. Some of us are going to make it through this by treading water, just making out to the other side. But while we're doing that, keep your head above water and look up.
Thank you, Matthew.
Thank you. That was fun.
Das war Folge 1. Mehr gute Typen finden Sie in unserem Printmagazin. Wir sind total gespannt, was Sie davon halten. Vielleicht mögen Sie es sich ja holen. Bleiben Sie uns treu. Bleiben Sie gute Typen.